It's the Balticon interview with author Patricia Bray. It's The Adventures of Indiana Jim, episode 13, for the week of July 14th, 2008.
And now, coming to you not exactly live from
the Cliffs of Insanity,
a man who needs no introduction, that international man of geekery, that intrepid arch-geekologist, Indiana Jim.
Well, it's certainly been long enough, don't you think? When was the last episode? I'm looking right here. June 14th. Wow. It's been a month. Holy cow. Time flies when you're wasting time, right? Yeah. I've been throwing around some ideas. But a month is about as long as it should be since the last episode. Lots of things happening, going on, going down. Good things, you know. I'm in a better place than I was a month ago. And Mrs. Indy and I have been kicking around some ideas, and I'm going to get her on the show. We did a practice run a while back where we were just discussing some movies and stuff, and we learned some things about how this will go. We're watching Battlestar Galactica. We're going back through the miniseries, and we just finished the miniseries last night, actually. And she had watched several episodes before in the past when we lived with her parents, but it was like 2 years ago when she actually watched any of it with me. So she always had questions about it and didn't understand. So we're going right from the beginning, and it was so cool just turning on that miniseries. And, you know, the music from the miniseries and early on in the season was quite different than where it is, where it stands now. And the development of the characters, the actors have actually gone far more with their performances than you might expect or you might remember. You know, Chief Tyrell was kind of a bright personality on the show back when he weighed less, actually. And I'm not sure if it's natural weight gain or if he's allowing himself to gain weight for the show, but he was skinnier, he was peppier, he was a much more bright individual. And it's remarkable to see how the characters really have come along physically as well as emotionally in their performances. You know, they're not stock characters. Not only are their characters progressing plot-wise in the things that happen to them, but they're progressing personality-wise. And I continue to be impressed by this show. And the things you learn early on, you know, the setup for things, for instance, in the miniseries when they mentioned the prison colony ship having 500 prisoners that were bound for wherever they were going. And, you know, episodes that seem to come out of nowhere really don't. They have their foundation in the miniseries or early episodes of the first season. You know, when the episode comes for Tom Zarek to assert himself and the prison colony ship gets its day on the show, it was set up right there at the beginning. You know, that conflict, that we better watch out for that because they may have some problems because they have hardened criminals aboard, and they end up having these problems because of the criminals aboard. So, you know, a lot of people, like season three, started saying, well, Battlestar has jumped the shark, you know, and I think a lot of people in our short attention span, we failed to take into account that a lot of this stuff was set up early on. So anyway, that's a bit of a philosophical discussion about Battlestar Galactica. What we are here for today is the Balticon interview with Patricia Bray. Had an opportunity to sit down and do three interviews back to back to back. About four interviews at Balticon. Wow. Patricia Bray, Joshua Palmateer, Matt Wallace, and Earl Newton and Dave Cantor. Now, those, the Matt Wallace and Stranger Things, which is Earl and Dave, you've already heard those interviews. And I'm just now getting around to posting this interview with Patricia Bray. A lot of interesting things happening in the author interview front. I was contacted by David Williams, and in fact, in the background of this interview, you'll hear two male voices and one female voice. I don't remember the lady's name. I don't believe I was introduced to her, but Joshua Palmateer you'll hear, and you'll also hear the voice of David Williams, David J. Williams, who emailed me a while back and asked if he could send me a copy of his book, The Mirrored Heavens, or Mirrored Heavens, it's not The Mirrored Heavens. Very, very cool book. It's like my quote on my pull quote, if I could make one, is like, it's Glenn Cook on crack makes Tom Clancy look like Tolkien, is basically what I would say. This sucker, there are no chapters. I think there's three or four books, you know, for segmentation, but there's no chapters. Each section follows a particular plot line. Each character just has one little symbol, self-contained symbol in like a circle, and so you know by the symbol at the beginning of each heading and right in the first sentence you know the characters. But it's really interesting. There are no chapters, there are no numbers at all, and it's very, very fast paced. You get a lot of stopping points, but it's not like a chapter recess, not like a big sigh. It's just kind of a breath and then you're back in. The dialogue is very, very good. The style is quite different than anything you've ever read. It's like cyberpunk on steroids, and it's very, very cool. And I'll give a full review later on, one of these days. But I'm going to have David Williams on the show eventually after I read this book. If you go to Autumn Rain 2110, I think autumnrain2110.com, you'll find his website and information about the book. Very detailed website. Has a lot of backstory for the plot. It's very cool. It's just very well done. And on another note, I have been asked by an author if they could have their publisher send me a book. I was like, okay, that's really cool. But the unique thing about this book, it is The Lost Realm Dragonscarp, I believe. The Lost Realm Volume 1 Dragonscarp. It is a tabletop, it's a coffee table illustrated fantasy novel. And I was like, well, that would be interesting. If you go to thelastrealm.com, you will find this book. Now, the illustrator has done a lot of work on some superhero stuff like Batman, more recent stuff. Very detailed drawings. Amazing paintings by this guy. And it's going to be coffee table size. This is a $38 book. And it's coffee table size novel. And I can't wait to get a hold of this thing because it just looks awesome. And, you know, it's like the Alan Lee, the famed illustrator of Tolkien works. And I forget the other guy's name, but it's like that kind of thing, except not the art book that you get. I mean, it's an actual novel. So be interesting to see how the story stands out. The author is a name I can't remember right off the top of my head. So what I'm going to do is go in my email, and I'm going to find out for you. It's Pat something. Pat Mech something. Yes, Pat Mac. What is the Mac? I'm going through here. I'm having a hard time finding it. Pat McNamara. Written and illustrated by Pat McNamara, Michael Dudkiewicz, and Gary Turner. Michael Dudkiewicz is the illustrator. Let's see. What has he worked on? Batman, Wolverine, and Lost in Space. So I don't know if it's recent stuff. I don't know if it's old stuff. He's multi-award winning illustrator and master pinup artist Michael Dudkiewicz. I don't know. I don't know whether that's new or old. But anyway, it's a very cool looking book. So I encourage you to go check it out. So I'm not sure if there's any more to say. The audio drama I'm working on is coming along nicely, but still not yet quite close to release time yet. And that all depends on the actors coming through for me. So anyway, that's enough of that. We are going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll begin the interview, excuse me, with Patricia Bray. So hang on.
In a world where you can't find a movie, the Cue the Film podcast comes at the most dismal time.
This movie is like, there's an implosion in like pretty colors.
This movie features a 3-hour clip of a wonderful waterfall falling.
Four men
and women
vow to do the impossible, to make a podcast where alien movies sappy love stories.
I love you, never let us part.
The bad news is, I'm dating Fisher Stevens.
And blockbusters.
I'm king of the world, even though I personally have a vagina.
We'll meet and coexist, kind of. I'm some random British guy you've probably never met, here to tell you the Cue the Film podcast is here. Find it at cuethefilm.blogspot.com.
Bring out your dad, bring out your dad.
Before the interview starts, I do want to say that I recently took part in an episode of the Cue the Film podcast with Emily from Ohio, Kentucky John, Jack Jaffe, my good friend, formerly Trucker Cylon, now Trucker Overdrive, Jack Jaffe, and Tosis in Germany. And we talked all about the Indiana Jones movies. So watch Cue the Film podcast for that episode to air. I'll let you know when it's out. And without anything further, the interview with Patricia Bray. All right. I am here at Balticon with Patricia Bray. Patricia, you won the Compton Crook Award for Devlin's Luck in 2003. Is that correct?
That is. Thank you for having me, Jim.
No problem. First question I want to get to. I'm curious how or why an author starts with romance novels under Zebra, an imprint of Kensington, in the world of Jane Austen, and then there's this seismic shift into epic fantasy with Bantam Spectra, the publisher of George R.R. Martin, no less. Your last Regency was in 2002, and Devlin's Luck was immediately after that.
Exactly.
Was the transition as seamless as it appears?
It was actually really interesting, because when I made the decision to actually start writing for publication, I made a conscious decision that it would be easier to break into the field as a romance writer than as a science fiction fantasy author.
Mm-hmm.
I always knew that I was interested in writing both. I enjoyed reading Regency romances. I enjoyed reading science fiction fantasy. But it was actually a decision that I made that I said it would be easier, I thought, to break in. So when I began writing, I joined a group of romance writers and I started working on the Regencies. But I always knew, even at that time, that I did want to write fantasy. So when I got my first agent after the book, I had talked to her and said, I'm doing Regencies right now, but what I want to do is I also want to do fantasy. And Jennifer Jackson had clients that were both romance clients and clients with science fiction fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about that as a career direction.
Okay.
After I'd done several Regencies, I reached the point where I was feeling very stifled by the genre, because there are, you know, fairly strict conventions in romance. One man, one woman, happy ending, no barnyard animals. So I was looking at that, and I really wanted the itch to do something bigger. I wanted to do more adventurous stories. I wanted to do something with a bigger scope. I looked at doing a longer historical romance, but that wasn't a good fit. So I put together Devlin's Luck as a project. And I actually wrote that between my fifth and sixth Regencies. I actually stole the time, wrote Devlin's Luck, and then wrote what turned out to be my final Regency while my agent was shopping Devlin's Luck around.
Mm-hmm. And you said your agent's Jennifer Jackson,
Jackson from the Donald Moss Agency.
Donald Moss Agency. It's interesting, because you usually hear about you can really only write in one genre with any one name.
Right.
Usually you have to try to branch out. And the publishers kind of frown on that, because they know what you're known for. So how was your agent able to make that happen?
Well, actually, I had the conversation with my editor, who's Ann Grohl at Bantam, who's also George's editor as well.
But cool.
So I had the, you know, I was totally prepared to take a pseudonym if that's what it took, because I knew I was excited to be with Bantam. I was really excited that they were going to be publishing Devlin's Luck.
Uh-huh.
So I said, you know, I said, Ann, is this going to be a problem? I'm published in Regency Romance. You know, obviously, the sales figures for my Regency Romances, I didn't want that influencing the buying decisions of the stores of the SF chain.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she said, no, she says, that's not going to be a problem. It's not going to confuse our sales force because it's such a total genre switch. It's so complete.
Yeah.
And I was like, you have a sales force.
Wow.
You know, going from Zebra, that was an interesting thought. But I was prepared for that because I knew that it was a very strong possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, fortunately for me, that wasn't a problem with Bantam. And so I was able to continue on as Patricia Bray.
That's very cool. Let's talk about Devlin's Luck, sort of change series. Describe briefly what the story is about.
I described it to someone at the con as a stranger rides into the town, is given the silver badge as a sheriff, and he cleans up the Old West. It's
mm-hmm.
very much of a classic Western tale sense.
Yeah.
It actually grew out of the idea of I'd read a number of stories about survivor's guilt. And, you know, and it was, I was looking at this, and I was like, these stories aren't realistic because everything is so neatly wrapped up, and, you know, it's, you know, I said, somebody who's been through that horrific event, they may get better, but they are never the same person they were. And so I started off with the idea of Devlin as a character, as somebody who had survived something very horrific, and the fact that this was going to influence everything he did for the rest of his life. And so I really wanted to do that, and so I put that together with the idea of the Chosen One, which is a very standard fantasy trope of the designated hero,
mm-hmm.
and rather than the designated hero being a coveted position that everyone vies for, which is often the standard treatment, it was like, oh no, 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 no. In my world, the designated hero is the designated guy with a target on his back,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's like, it's the post no one wants.
Right.
It's, you know, it's like the sheriff in the Old West town was a life expectancy of the next gunfight.
Right.
So,
well, and what I find interesting is it's almost the tongue-in-cheek nature. You handle it in sort of almost a comic way because it's not as, say, like a movie like Unforgiven where it's very, very, a very, very tense type thing. It's sort of like a afterthought. You know,
yes.
This guy is on his last legs. He needs the money, basically.
Right,
and so he decides, well, I'll just go ahead and take this job.
You know, it's you know, I mean, it's a very, I have a very dark sense of humor, very black sense of humor. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's like, you know, I mean, Devlin takes the job because while he was drunk in a bar, he hears about this and says, this is a way to get money. You know, there's not a lot of careful planning and forethought going from it.
Right.
And, you know, and around him, even at his ceremony where he's taking the oath of being the chosen one, the people are betting on how long he's going to live. I mean, it's a very cynical worldview there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's looking at this. And, of course, the thing about Devlin is that, you know, I call it Devlin's Luck because what saves him is he has both good luck and bad luck influences a lot of the story. And
right.
so the Devlin's Luck was actually a play on that. You know,
right.
he's the only one who could get, you know, he has it, one of the things, one of his adventures, he goes to an inn where travelers have been disappearing from the forest. And Devlin happens to have an allergic reaction to the food he served, so he is violently ill before the poison can affect him.
Yeah.
So unlike the other guests who had gone to sleep and been knifed, Devlin is out being sick in the, you know, in the latrine, and then he comes in time to figure out that the innkeepers are doing the murderer. But that's the kind of luck he has. You know, no one wants to go into a sword fight as you're, you know, you're clenching your gut, you know, still racking
mm-hmm.
with the heaves and, like, you know, fighting
right.
for your life.
Right. And in the Regencies, the romance obviously is the center of the story. And the sort of change, the two primary male and female characters don't get in that type of relationship.
Right.
And in fact, you made Captain Draken older because your beta reader expected them to be paired up. Was this a decision because you wanted to steer away from comparisons to your work with the Regencies?
It was. I wanted to steer away from having the romance feel. I didn't want to do that. And to be honest, I was burned out on that.
You know,
I was burned out on writing the romantic relationship, so I wanted to do something that was completely different. And so I had a character, Devlin, very much, who, when he had a romantic, squishy feeling, went out and killed something instead, you know?
Yeah.
It was like, you know, it was very much, you know, a complete departure for me. And I had done, you know, with the character of Captain Draken, as you said, I deliberately aged her in order to make that clear that that was not going to be a romantic relationship.
Right.
So, you know, and that was the phase I had to go through after having done the Regencies.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move into your current work. The Final Sacrifice is set for release on June 14th, is that correct?
24th. Yep.
Something with a four.
Yeah, it's coming out in about 4 weeks.
Okay, and these are what your fans call the Lizard Books.
The Lizard Books.
The Chronicles of Joseon. Tell us about that series.
Well, it was interesting because I pitched it to my editor at a Worldcon, and you've been to one of these conventions. And by the time Sunday morning comes around, all of us are a little worse for the wear, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And so I'm at a breakfast meeting with my editor, where, you know, Anne's there, and her husband Dave's there, and myself, and we're all looking at each other over our coffee. And so she says, well, what are you going to do now the Devlin books are done? I said, well, I have an idea. I says, but I've just done a medieval fantasy. I said, it was set, you know, in a very, you know, Germanic setting. It was medieval, it was cold, it was... I want to do something different. I want to set something that's sort of Renaissance-y. It's going to be very tropical, and there'll be lizards going around everywhere. And Anne's eyes lit up, and she goes, lizards, I like it. And so then I explained the plot of, you know, the story to them, and her husband Dave turns and says, The Man Who Would Be Lizard. That's the title. And Anne's like, you two never sit together.
Oh, gosh.
But it's an interesting book because it has to do a lot with the questions of identity, which is something that I was really interested in, is like, who are you? And if your memories aren't your own, you know, where's your identity? Is it in your physicality? Is it in your actions? Is it how much your identity is tied up in your memories and what you know about yourself? And of course, the character Joseon is so much of what he knows about himself to be true is ultimately proven to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But the story starts out in, you know, in the first betrayal, is Joseon is a monk. He's at the furthest corner of the empire. He's tending a lighthouse, which is one of the duties of his order. He's been banished from the central colleges where he had grown up. He's tending the lighthouse, which is a very tedious existence. And one day, an assassin arrives to kill him. And, you know, he manages to not be killed, and in fact, he manages to defeat the assassin. And this brings to mind, how did I learn how to fight? I have no memory of knowing how to fight.
Right.
And why is someone trying to kill me? And Joseon realizes the answers to these questions have to be back with his past.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes back to the capital city, and he's been warned against going there. And of course, when he gets there, they're like, Prince Lucius, you're here with your people to lead us in rebellion. He's like, oh, crap, because this is not where he wants to be. And he realizes what's going on. It's like he's now, you know, as he's back, this is the one place he should never have gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he should never have come there. And so, you know, from there on, everything goes downhill, which is what you expect in a Patricia Bray book.
It kind of reminds me of sort of a Born Identity moment.
Yes. You know, it's funny you should say that because I've recently, you know, saw the movies again. But yeah, it's very much a Born Identity moment where, you know, again, like everything he thinks to be true, he realizes that, no, actually, my fundamental premise about who I am is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there on it goes. We do that, and then, like, now I'm really, you know, a lot of readers have been saying, like, how are you going to wrap this up in the Final Sacrifice, which is really cool. So
right.
We'll get to see.
I'm getting very nervous about the word sacrifice and what that means. I like my characters, but George Martin has taught me to hold them loosely. Now, you continue to redefine roles of women in this series with a very strong character in Lady Isabel. Tell us briefly about her and where that comes from your own experience.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, part of the setup for the world that Joseon is in, again, very Renaissance-y, is I have the Emperor of Icaria, the Empire of Icaria, which is set up, it's very much of a Roman type of setup. Women have very restricted roles, except, of course, there's a reigning empress, which is, you know, but she is the sole exception. Women have very restricted roles. It's very much the way we would think of our history.
No relation to the real Icaria.
No, yes, exactly. The name has been changed to protect the guilty. But the Federated Islands of Sidon, where Lady Isabel is from, is very much based on the way that the independent city-states of Italy were during the Renaissance, particularly Venice and the trading houses.
Uh-huh.
So it's ruled basically by these great merchant houses. Houses which are dominated by families, and the merchants were very cunning. They had the idea that it doesn't matter how much weight you can carry, we need brains, and women have brains as well as men. So they have a completely different attitude to that, to the roles of men and women, which Lady Isabel actually gets to illustrate, because when she's in the Empire of Icaria, her intelligence, her cunning is automatically discounted. No one believes a woman is capable of these things, so she's actually able to get away with a lot of things because she's constantly being underestimated.
Right.
But I had really interesting time with her character. I mean, from the moment she stepped on stage in the very first book, she was a central figure. She was very vibrant, and I had to work hard to make sure she didn't overtake the story because she was such an interesting person to write.
Yeah.
But she's, you know, I mean, she's very strong. She's very cunning, and part of the journey that she takes as she goes through the books is she redefines who she is and what her values are.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of women who emphasize strong female characters, some of them do it from a almost like a reactive standpoint to the situations in their lives. Was that the case with you, or did you just feel like that's the natural thing to do with a main character?
Well, I think, you know, I'm part of Lady Isabel, you know, is certainly informed by the number of strong women that I know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I don't feel that she's reactionary, she's a stretch. I mean, she's no more than a stretch than the other characters I'm writing. I know, you know, strong women, independent women who are very single-minded as she is in focusing on her goals and achieving those goals. And you look around and I see quite a few of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I was, I was very conscious when I was writing the book that I was writing about two different societies, so the women of the Icarian society, I had to write them differently than I was writing about Lady Isabel and her counterparts over in her society. And that was, you know, depending which point of view character you're in, they're viewing the women and their roles differently.
Mm-hmm. And so the Lady Isabel comes into Icaria and basically, it's almost like she starts her own little group on the side. And as a woman, she becomes sort of this political leader, which is kind of unusual.
She does. And what's really interesting is I loved writing her in the first book because I really wanted a character who could believably say, "Fetch me pretty boys."
That was one of the more interesting things about her.
Yeah, and you know, of course, what that is because the Icarians are automatically suspicious of her. She's in there as an, you know, an ambassador rank, you know, which drives them crazy because the men don't want to have to deal with a woman who has authority. So she deliberately cultivates a reputation as a loose woman who's sleeping her way around. And then, of course, the Icarian nobles and government's like, oh, my God, she's this horrible tramp from the foreign country. So then the constant stream of men in and out of her house, no one's paying attention to the fact that she's running a giant spy network right under their noses. That's what's, you know, she's three steps ahead of anyone as far as that goes. She's always, everything she does has at least three different meanings. You know, she's always, you know, it's not, she doesn't do anything with a single purpose. She's way far ahead of that. She's a great grasp of tactics. And in The Sea Change, which was the second book, you got to see her grasp of, you know, tactics applied to military situations.
Yeah. One of the more interesting things I find about you is the fact that you're in an interesting position. You either have authors who are well-established that everyone wants to interview, or you have people that are struggling to get books published, or even people that are doing podcast novels, like a lot of my friends. But you're in an interesting spot because you're right in the transition period between full-time day job and full-time writer. It seems odd because usually the romantic version is that of the frustrated artist languishing in a toll booth somewhere. Your job probably keeps you very busy and very engaged. You're a IT project manager. So how do you balance that?
It's really interesting, Jim, because it's, you know, I work about 60 hours a week, and I'm now, you know, the new alignment, I'm working some nights every month, which is a little challenging to me. So it's hard to balance that with the writing schedule, and to be honest, I would be more successful if I could write two books a year. I would be at a different stage in my career.
Mm-hmm.
I can write one book a year on average, so that puts me at one level, you know.
Right.
I can't, you know, for instance, if I switch genres again, I will not be able to keep two careers going. You know, I wouldn't be able, if I could write two books a year, I could easily keep doing epic fantasy at the same time I did something else, say, you know, police procedurals, mysteries, but with one book a year, you really have to make some hard choices.
Right. You've been published pretty steadily for about 11 years, is that right?
Yep.
Devlin's Luck is going, it's in its fifth printing, is that correct?
It's either fifth or sixth. I know there's at least five out there.
Are any other the other books going back for reprints also?
Oh, yeah, everything's in print.
Wow,
so everything keeps going back. I'm really amazed. I still get fan letters from the Devlin books. I got a fan letter the other day. I still, you know, those really connected with people, and they really like the character of Devlin. And in fact, you know, I got a letter the other day from somebody who said, like, "I'm going to WorldCon in Denver. I can't wait to meet you."
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, that's awesome. It's really great to hear from the fans that do that.
Mm-hmm.
The new series with the Chronicles of Joseon, that's doing well. Those have been going back to press as well. What's very cool is that all my fantasies have been sold over in Russia, and there are Russian translations of them, which is, you know, it's just awesome when you get the author's copy over there and you see your name, and, you know, I now have to Google my name in Cyrillic, and, you know, the titles, and you see the book, and, you know, it was actually, I found a discussion board in, you know, talking about Devlin's Luck that was in Russian. So then, of course, I used Google's Babelfish to translate it, and it, this, the beginning review is, Devlin is a depressed humming bear.
Humming bear.
Humming bear. And I'm like, this translation software needs a little tweaking, yeah. I think, at this moment. Yeah.
Definitely.
But it is so, it is cool, and it is nice to have that out there.
When are you going to know that it's time to move into full-time writing?
That'll be an interesting decision. You know, if I can keep...
So no, they don't typically give benefits to
offers on the roster. To be honest, it's the 401k and the healthcare right now. They're keeping me employed. You know, the advice that we get from most agents is, you know, you should be able to support yourself on your royalties, not advances, but you should be making enough on royalties every year to quit your daytime job, and that's the sign. You know, because, of course, advance checks come, you know, irregularly. I would like, you know, if I could get a few more years in at the day job, that would be fabulous. I don't see myself working at that till I'm 65, but a few more years would be interesting.
All right. Let's go back a ways and kind of explain what got you started writing.
Well, you know, like a lot of writers, I always knew I wanted to write one day. That was something I thought about. I wrote in high school, but I also knew I didn't want to be poor.
Yeah.
So I went to college for computer science, and I was programming, and that's very creative, and I did that. And when I turned 30, I started to have the itch. And a friend said, look, there's a critique group of writers for me in the area. She says, do you want to join with me? She says, I want to join, but I don't want to join alone. Will you come with me?
Mm-hmm.
And so I joined the group, and that actually turned out to be, they were interested in writing romance, and it turned out to be a romance writing critique circle. And it was really great being around it because everyone wanted to be published. Everyone was seriously writing. We'd bring chapters in every week. People would bring in and show the pages they wrote. And that was really energizing. And when I joined that group, I actually got the discipline to write and finish a novel.
Yeah.
That novel didn't sell.
Right.
I wrote and finished another novel. The second novel sold. So, and then since then, it's been pretty good.
Very cool. What authors... I know Jane Austen is one of your very favorite authors. What authors in the fantasy realm or what particular works have influenced your enjoyment of the adventure, the action adventure, sword and sorcery sort of thing?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, if I name drop, I'm going to forget someone. I'm going to walk out of here and go like, you know, like, oh my God, I should have mentioned that. I mean, there's some authors that I'm completely in awe of, you know, whether that's, you know, Robin McKinley or Patricia McKillop. I mean, I remember reading Patricia McKillop's Riddle Master of Head series and thinking those books were perfectly written, that they, you know, that you couldn't change a word in them. They were so well done when I read them as a teenager. I mean, that they were just awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as like David Gemmell's work, you know, I mean, he did fabulous books as far as the fantasies go.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, now I'm blanking on names. But
were there influences from your childhood or teenage years?
Those are from my teenage years, but I mean, I've always read omnivorously, you know, and the joke about Westerns is, you know, I read Westerns, I read mysteries, I read crime thrillers, I read romance, you know.
Right.
I've had the talk with my agent that said, like, you know, I don't read in one genre, I don't see any reason why my career should be confined to one genre.
Yeah.
So I fully intend to write mysteries, I fully intend to move into other genres, you know. Now, admittedly, I may have to be writing, as, you know, instead of Patricia Bray, it may be, you know, like Serena Smith published is a Western, but, you know, I mean, it could happen someday.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting because, yeah, I've got a lot of different ideas like that myself, and that's, it's something that I've noticed about you, so it's kind of another reason why I'm kind of attracted to your work. Do you still have time to quilt?
No, I don't have time to quilt. I lost my quilting partner, too, so, but yeah, I used to do quilting. We used to do, couple of quilts a year we would do together.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't have as much time for reading as I used to, obviously.
Yeah,
I mean, that's my reading pace. I still buy as if I can read 3-4 books a week. I can't. If I get 3 or 4 a month, it's been a good month. But I'm buying at a pace, you know.
Yeah.
I was up at the dealer's rooms, dropped a bunch of money in books there. So, but I mean, it's you wind up picking and choosing what you're going to give up, you know,
right.
With the day job and with the writing. And, you know, last year when I was working The Final Sacrifice, I actually joined the Novel 90 group in order to help me keep focus for that final push because I was having a hard time balancing things, so I joined that. But it was a miserable period of 3 months where I didn't see movies. I, you know, didn't have time for friends. It was just I had to push and just get the book done.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the balance is like that.
Yeah. You are an avid bicyclist.
Yes.
You've been a lot of different places, some of the most spectacular vistas in North America. What are some of the favorite places that you like to go?
Well, you know, what's interesting is I do the bike trip once a year, and I do it with my friend Stacy, who used to be my quilting partner. And so we get together once a year and we do these trips.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's really interesting. I did the first bike trip I did, long trip, was a trip in Ireland, actually, which was really interesting because I did a 10-day bike trip. And you get a whole different perspective about, like, moving through the landscape and moving through the country, which is really good for a fantasy writer because, you know, you're not in a car. You're interacting with the environment. It is pouring buckets of rain, and you're still riding. You know,
yeah.
I remember one day in Ireland where it just poured torrentially, and we were hammered. We had to do 60 miles, and, you know, I got into town. I was soaking wet and covered in mud. But
oh,
it's
man.
Ireland, so, of course, I parked the bike by the pub, and I just walk into the pub, and it's just like, you know, give me a beer. You know, they're no one cares. You know, I mean, you're dripping wet, you're covered in mud.
Wearing spandex and a plastic helmet.
Yeah, that's the part that separated the American tourists from the Irish, because the Irish, of course, they'd be wearing all wool and, like, you know, shoes with leather soles, and we're like in our bike gear, and we've got our Gore-Tex from L.L. Bean, but. Yeah, we do that. I mean, it's really interesting for me, and I usually do a lot of thinking about my projects. Last year, we were out in Oregon. We did Crater Lake, the area of Oregon, one of the best bike, top sceneries, really amazing. But while I was on the bike trip, of course, I had my notebook. I was actually taking notes for one of the projects that I'm working on right now. I had thoughts, you know. I didn't have a computer with me. Travel a little light on these trips, you know, not lugging a laptop around. But I did a lot of thinking about that while I was on the trip.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we've done a lot, you know. The Canadian Rockies trip we did was awesome.
Yeah.
We did Bryce Sign in Utah. That was really different landscape because I grew up in the Northeast. So, like, seeing Utah and, like, the deserts and the rocks, I mean, that was actually amazing.
Yeah. I ran into you, I guess it was today, wasn't it, this morning? And you were working on, you were editing your next project.
I'm working on my next project, which is a proposal for an urban fantasy right now that my agent has and is shopping around.
Okay. So is that the next project in the foreseeable future, or are there other things burning in there?
Well, there's a couple of different proposals that are out there right now,
okay.
So we'll have to see which one bites. So
mm-hmm.
I did, I wanted to do something a little different, so I put together a proposal for urban fantasy. I actually took a course in criminal investigations in the fall.
Right.
I
mm-hmm.
took a college course in that, which is totally awesome. It was a really interesting class to take. The instructor was a retired FBI field agent. Had some very interesting stories to tell.
Yeah.
But that was a lot of fun, you know, researching that, looking at the police procedures, looking at the forensic side of things. So there's that proposal that's out there, and there's another epic fantasy. And then I still get emails from readers who want me to go back to Devlin's story, and they want me to, like, either continue with Devlin or to tell Stephen's story.
Yeah,
so, you know.
The minstrel.
The minstrel,
the minstrel
yeah.
prince.
Yeah, the minstrel who did not quite get killed.
Yeah.
And the important thing about this is it's a valuable life lesson for authors. Do not let your beta reader get too attached to a character, because I couldn't kill Stephen off because my beta reader threatened to kill me.
Oh, my goodness.
So I actually wrote the scene where, like, Devlin briefly believes Stephen has been killed just to torture her.
It was very funny because he's sort of like the rebellious noble that wants to be a minstrel and write these epic songs.
He's trying very hard. But what's interesting is, you know, I mean, Stephen's whole character arc throughout the books is, like, discovering, you know, the difference between heroism as it's told in stories and songs and what it really means to be a hero.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and actually at the end of the book, Stephen is, you know, has discovered that he himself is capable of heroic actions, but that to be a hero is something totally different than what he had conceived of before he met Devlin.
Right.
So.
Right, okay.
He's actually grows up.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, one of the thing that draws me, I guess, to your book is your books are, they're concise. You know, you don't spend a lot of time writing travelogues.
Yes.
You know, you kind of stick with the action and adventure. You make it kind of campy, and it's very accessible to new readers across genres because you're so well read, you kind of avoid the tropes or you twist the tropes very well.
I twist the tropes. I don't spend a lot of time describing the scenery because that's not interesting to me. You know, there are some authors who have these wonderful, lush, vivid descriptions, but when I'm reading their books, it's like, I don't care how many different types of stones are in the castle. That's not interesting to me. I want to know, are they friendly or hostile? Are they likely to attack? That's the only thing, you know, like, you know, is the gate up or down? That's the part that's important. Is the boiling oil coming over? Are they waving, saying, hi, welcome? Those are the kind of things that interest me. So that, you know, it's similarly, like, I don't spend a lot of time explaining what people are wearing. In fact, for The Final Sacrifice, it was really interesting that the art department passed me on a memo from the artist, Steve Stone, who, in his most British and polite way, said, could the author possibly describe what any one of her characters might be wearing at any point? Could I have some hair, perhaps, a style of clothing, perhaps a movie she is fond of? And, of course, Steve, you know, Steve was totally right. There wasn't a lot of clothing description in book three, especially, so I, like, put something together, and then I just did my usual thing, which is, like, please tell Steve whatever he does for the cover is going to be gorgeous. I'm not going to be, you know, do a cover that's gorgeous. That's what I want. I'm not going to be nitpicking going, you know, my robes end at the ankle and you have them show knee high. And that makes me, I'm totally not. I'm like, I want a gorgeous cover. And that's, of course, that's what Steve delivered was another gorgeous cover.
Right. And that's a reasonable expectation for most authors that usually don't get to give any details.
I know. I don't, you know, people say, like, oh, I'm so upset because of my cover, like, the guy is holding this kind of gun, and actually it's, you know, it's just like, it should be a Ruger, but instead they have a Smith & Wesson, and those details aren't important, you know, it's like, does the cover convey the sense of the book, and this cover has an excellent sense of the book, you know, it's like the cover for Devlin's Luck, you know, when I first looked at it, I'm like, okay.
It's not even close.
There's nothing that's even close, but it had the really cool-ass lake monster. I mean, it was like, it was like this cool lake monster on the cover, and I looked and said, that's exactly the feeling of the book. I mean, you get the sword and you get sorcery feeling, you get the cool lake monster, you get the montage of what's going on.
Right.
Then I noticed, like, you know, I mean, each of the Devlin books, Devlin gets progressively younger on the covers as you look at them. So I'm like, you know, is that the artist's boyfriend? I mean, I don't know, like, you know, it's like, you know, he's getting younger and hotter with each book.
Yeah, maybe that's the artist himself.
Yeah, it could be. It could be a little wish fulfillment.
All right. She is Patricia Bray. Tell us the websites where people can find out more about you.
You can go to patriciabray.com or Google Patricia Bray and Devlin's Luck. You'll find out all about the books. I also have a blog at pbray.livejournal.com, which you can also find from my website, where I'll ramble on about books I enjoy reading, the writing process, what I do at cons, or where the next bike trip's going to be.
And I follow your live journal almost religiously.
Yes, and you're frequently commented on it, and always well appreciated.
All right, well, I thank you very much for doing this interview. I'm a big fan, and I'm very glad that you are a down-to-earth, approachable, friendly person.
Well, thank you so much, Jim. It's been great chatting with you, and it's been great hanging out with you.
All right, well, thank you.
Yes, that is the indomitable spirit, Patricia Bray. Next week, I'm going to have the interview with Joshua Palmateer on here for you, and maybe within 2 weeks, I can figure out what I'm going to do after that. I know I want to feature for you Star Wars Second Strike, the audio drama written and produced by Nathan Butler, the first Star Wars audio drama released on the internet, I think, back in 2002. Basically an outgrowth of the fan films thing, and it was originally intended as a script for a fan film. A little bit about Patricia Bray. If you have not checked out her books, check out the Devlin Stonehand trilogies, Devlin's Luck, Devlin's Honor, and Devlin's Justice, and also the Chronicles of Joseon, which you may have heard recently featured on the Dragon Page podcast, and it was pronounced Joseon by Michael Stackpole. Anyway, The First Betrayal, The Sea Change, and The Final Sacrifice, which just came out last month on the 24th of June. Check those out. She's very good. She limits herself. Basically, she sticks with the parts that are important about the book. She doesn't engage in a lot of fantasy novel navel-gazing. It's not a travelogue like Tolkien. It's concise, it's fun, it's action-packed, and it doesn't waste a lot of your time. So if you want to find something that's just a good read with a twist on the Chosen One idea, then definitely check out Devlin's Luck. So, with that all said, I think I'm pretty much done. Remember the voicemail at 206-350-8474. Leave me a voicemail. Please leave me a voicemail. Don't let my K7 account go by the wayside this time. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. I'll expect you back here next week for Joshua Palmateer. In the meantime, things are looking up. Bet you never thought you'd hear that again, would you?
You've been listening to The Adventures of Indiana Jim, a production of Visionary Creative Works. Visit podcast.indianajim.net and leave comments on the blog. Send in your emails and audio feedback to podcast@indianajim.net. I'm Dr. John Small. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.